Well, Harry Styles arrived there today, sending hearts fluttering, hearts which were presumably already aflutter when Timothée Chalamet's red carpet appearance happened over the weekend. I'm talking, of course, about this year's Venice Film Festival, which has a bumper crop of Oscar-y-looking films in competition this year. Venice 2022 has it all. The films, the stars, the haute couture, and the backbiting gossip. More of that anon. Joining us from a very hot and humid Venice this evening is Tara Brady. We're probably not going to get a lot of sympathy for that particular aspect of Venice, Tara.
I do have mosquito bites, I should point out.
All right. Okay. And well, let's find out if you have Chalamet and Styles bites. We'll find out about that later as well. It is really its own being, the Venice Film Festival. And it managed quite well during the COVID period when lots of others were kind of put to the wall.
It did indeed. It has, by virtue of being in September, it actually got very lucky. So they were in that like brief window, if you remember, between lockdowns, and they were able to continue through the 2020 festival and then last year. But there would have been, for example, last year, still a big barrier around the red carpet where ordinarily crowds gather. But the barrier is well and truly down, and there has been an awful lot of screaming over the last few days. I mean, it feels like a really, really big deal hoopla festival this year. You would ordinarily have to go to a big concert to see the numbers of teenage girls that have been pouring in. I mean, some of them are carrying signs with I've driven 100 miles or I've driven 200 miles. And this morning when I was coming along, because of course it's Harry Styles Day, I was coming along at 8 this morning, and they were already sort of 3 deep around the red carpet at that point. So they've been here all day, just to get a glimpse of Harry in his Gucci. So it's always as well, being unlike Cannes, it's a slightly more democratic affair, partly because the public can go and gather around the red carpet, but also they can buy tickets, which is something that can't happen at Cannes. So there's a real sense of it being the more like the People's Festival, as it were.
And I know, Tara, that if you're in fear that you may have to move around a little bit even as we speak, because the screaming can become quite problematic for radio.
Yeah, you better believe it. I mean, this is quite soundproof, but there's still so much milling around. And then, of course, there's people returning from the red carpet. And I will say there's a lot of freelance photographers come from all over the world. And I don't think, I think they're very happy this festival between Timothée Chalamet and Harry Styles. I think they've got enough shots to pay the rent this month.
Yeah, it would seem that, and particularly that it's two men that are on the red carpet and causing all the glamour fuss. It's quite interesting in its own way, isn't it? And Oscar buzz from very early on here. This is Cate Blanchett in a film called Tar. What's the film about?
It's a fairly long old haul. It's almost 3 hours long. It's the film from new film from Todd Field. It's been many years in the making. And when it starts off, you think, oh, it's a film about this genius conductor, and we get an awful lot of like chunks of information about female conductors and conductors in history and where this particular conductor sits within the canon and all that sort of stuff. And she's getting ready, gearing up to conduct the Berlin Symphony and a performance of Mahler's Fifth. And that's what you think the film is about. But as the film goes on, it becomes a much more caustic and sort of sinister character study. And you realize this isn't some girl boss character. This person is a genuine predator, and really, really capable of maybe anything. And you get used. It's revealed in a very kind of slow drip feed over significantly long time. But yes, it's quite a huge performance. She really could be in the frame for her third Academy Award, which would even her up with Katharine Hepburn, which is not a bad place to be.
It's important to say it's a fictional conductor and composer, this Lydia Tarr woman. Let's listen to Cate Blanchett as the fictional conductor and composer discussing her practice.
Time is the thing. Time is the essential piece of interpretation. You can't
sometimes my second hand stops, which means time stops. The reality is that it's not until I once again decide to raise that hand that time is allowed to continue marching along her very merry way.
Even in that short clip of 42 seconds, you get a sense of the type of power that Cate Blanchett as Lydia Tarr likes to wield as the baton wielder. By the way, you mentioned Mahler's Fifth. We have a real life conductor coming in to talk about Mahler's Fifth, which is happening in the National Concert Hall on Friday evening. And Jaime Martín will be talking about that tomorrow. But this does really sound as if it takes the whole conducting thing to outrageous levels, or is it nuanced in how it treats it, Tara?
There is no nuance whatsoever in this. But if you are interested in conducting, you will get an awful lot of information. You'll get a lot of information about Mahler's Fifth. You'll get a lot of information about Elgar's and all kinds of information about music generally. But you know, because of course, like Todd Field actually does come from a musical background. Yes. But I very much hope this does not resemble anyone living or dead.
Okay, let's go on to Brendan Fraser then, he of the Mummy fame. They're talking about a kind of a comeback for him here with The Whale about obesity. How has it been treated, the subject of obesity, in this film?
It's quite controversial already, this film. Brendan Fraser, I mean, he's absolutely terrific in the role. And if you remember a few years ago with Matthew McConaughey and the Renaissance, as they called it, and people are already using the term Renaissance. So get used to that. It's a horrible thing you're going to find yourself using very soon. It's a really, really great turn from him. It's an adaptation of a fairly not very well-known play by Darren Aronofsky. And it's not the kind of film that we normally associate with Darren Aronofsky. He's made films like, you know, Black Swan. And, you know, we usually expect something darker from him. But this is a very sentimental film. It's rather more sentimental even than The Wrestler, which was Mickey Rourke's comeback film, if you remember. About 10 years ago. This is a film about a 600-pound man who's dying. He's eating himself to death, partly because he's mourning the death of his lover, and he's also very alienated because he walked out on his family, and he tries to reconnect with his teenage daughter, who's played by Sadie Sink from Stranger Things, and she's another person who brought out all the teenage girls on the red carpet the other day. It's a kind of a strange one because I don't think the play around it never escapes the fact that it's a play. It feels like a film play. It doesn't really do anything to look very much like a film. And then there's also an issue of it's sort of gets into that fatsploitation area that you get on those reality shows in America, where, you know, my 300-pound life and whatnot. And yeah, so it does feel a little bit, it feels a little bit dodgy.
I suppose Irish interest, Tara, will be in and around Martin McDonagh and the Banshees of Inisherin, filmed last summer on Achill and Inisherin. More. And what a cast he has assembled here.
You even get a Dunbelievables reunion. It has like lots of lovely supporting turns from lots of Irish veteran character actors: Pat Short, David Pearce, John Kenny, Sheila Flitton. I suppose all eyes will be on Brendan Gleeson and Colin Farrell in the main roles, but it's worth noting that Kerry Condon absolutely steals every scene that she appears in. It's a really nice return to form, I think, for not that he was ever off form, but I think it feels like a return to Martin McDonagh's roots. The film stars Brendan Gleeson as a fairly sophisticated fiddle player named Colm, and then Colin Farrell as the kind of local Gombe named Porrick, and they live on an unnamed island, presumably somewhere like Achill. One afternoon, Porrick calls into Colm to go to the pub as usual, and he's told that they're no longer friends, and he doesn't know why this has happened. Meanwhile, on the mainland, away from the island, you can see the evidence of the civil war, and you'll see explosions. And this is sort of at best treated with indifference by the locals. Now, I'm not too sure about if I buy this as an allegory for the Civil War, because I do think a lot of people in the country weren't as dismissive as most of the locals were in this film. But the escalation of conflict between the two men is so brilliantly played and written. It reminded me a lot of the Lonesome West and the way that escalated. And while the dialogue does feel like it could be a McDonagh play, the sort of cinematography has its own dialogue with films like John Ford's The Quiet Man. It's Colin is really great. He's that strange sort of flattened innocence that he does in the films he made with Georges Lanthimos. It sort of builds on that. Mm. And I suspect Brendan Gleeson will find, may well get his Academy Award as a supporting actor. Also worth noting Barry Keoghan, who's really nervy and kind of on edge as the only person in the village who's dumber than Colin's character. And so it's an absolute delight.
Yeah, well, I mean, it'd be very interesting to see how somebody like Martin McDonagh handles that whole Civil War type of story with that black comedy of his. It'd be interesting to see how that pans out for sure. Let's move on to, we'll move back, shall I say, really, to Timothy. He almost broke the internet, it has to be said. That red jumpsuit of his, red jumpsuit on the red carpet, not many people can manage that one. However, let's
pull that off.
let's concentrate on his film, perhaps, for the sake of this discussion. Bones and all, reunites him with Call Me By Your Name director Luca Guadagnino.
Guadagnino, yes, indeed. It's a strange one for him because it's not a film I think anyone was expecting him to make. It's an adaptation of a popular YA novel. And you know the thing with YA novels, ordinarily something happens at the beginning and the person discovers that they're really a witch or they really have to go to Hogwarts or something. But in this one, the young heroine realizes that she's actually a young cannibal. And she ends up meeting other young cannibals and some not so young cannibals on one of the absolutely breathtakingly pretty road trip across the United States. So Timothy Chalamet and Taylor Russell are the two kind of young cannibals in love in the story. And then you have Mark Rylance basically channeling a Night of the Hunter, really, really creepy sort of a role, sucking in on his teeth as one, and he's one of several creepy older cannibals they encountered along the way. And the film is actually at its best when it's just absolute puppy love and it has this great 80s soundtrack. Right. Taylor Russell, who you might remember from Waves, is terrific. And there's also a really scary cameo from Chloe Sevigny that required one of the members of the public, as we were saying, they're allowed to buy tickets here, and they needed medical staff to carry them out of the cinemas the other day.
There you go. Let's have a quick listen to a clip featuring the aforementioned Taylor Russell. Her character is called Maren Yearly. She's playing a teenage cannibal. And then Timothy Chalamet, she has loads of questions for him.
What was it like?
A rush. You could feel every blood vessel like spider webbing through me. Like some kind of weird new superhero.
What about afterward? What'd you feel about it? What'd you think?
I don't remember after.
That's bullshit.
Hey, I'm not just gonna tell you what you want to hear. You ask me a question, I gotta answer it.
And that's Timothy Chalamet and Taylor Russell there in Bones and All. Finally then, I mentioned the bit of gossip in and around, and this time it's in and around Shia LaBeouf, making waves on screen and off screen. Tell me a bit about both and we'll leave it at that for this evening, Tara.
Yeah, no, it's worth mentioning. There's some absolutely brilliant films that I've seen, like Athena and Monica and all kinds of great films, but almost all of the chatter has been around Don't Worry, Darling, and that's been the case since the film was in production back in 2020. How Shia is concerned in this is he was originally cast in the role that was recast with Harry Styles. As you probably know, the film is a sort of Stepford Wives type drama, of which Florence Pugh and Harry Styles are this idyllic couple living in an experimental community in what we think is the 1960s. It's the second feature from actor turned director Olivia Wilde, and there's been controversy around it since it went into production, not least from many of the Harry Styles fans who weren't at all happy when Harry was stolen away from them by Olivia, and they've been together ever since. Insiders on the set have reportedly, have leaked stories about the set being unhappy because Wilde and Styles were, when they were getting together, not paying enough attention to the filming. We don't know if that's true, but we do know that for several months, Instagrammers have noted that Florence Pugh hasn't been liking Olivia's posts on Instagram. And then last week we had a big bombshell, which was from Shia LaBeouf, who's starring in Padre Pio here from Abel Ferrara, which is a really terrific and terrifically odd film. And he leaked a video which indicated that, contrary to the official story, he was not fired from the movie. And more damningly, there was footage in the video in which Olivia Wilde referred to a wake-up call for Miss Flo, meaning Florence Pugh. As of today, this has been an absolute madhouse because while the press conference was going on, which Florence Pugh did not attend, Olivia Wilde was sitting there during the press conference going, Florence is really busy shooting Dune 2, so she couldn't make it here in time. That seems odd because Timothée was here for days and he's the star of Dune 2. And that also seems odd because while she was speaking those very words, Florence Pugh was photographed wearing a purple Valentino bra and hot pants suit, striding across Venice and carrying a Campari.
Why not? That's what you should be doing in Venice, I guess. Now, I know you have to beat your way through the Harry Styles or Timothée Chalamet, or perhaps both crowds, to go to your screenings this evening. Tara, enjoy what's left of it for you over there, and we'll talk to you, I'm sure, when you get back. And thanks for being with us this evening.
Yeah, of course.
That's Tara Brady reporting from the Venice Film Festival 2022, bringing us to 21 minutes past seven almost. Dublin-based singer-songwriter Katie Kim releases her sixth full-length album, Hour of the Ox, this Friday. The record is intended to represent a new beginning, since it is also set to be her concluding work under the Katie Kim moniker. Written and recorded while in the process of moving to New York and subsequently mixed after returning to Ireland during the pandemic, Hour of the Ox tells a story of longing, desperation for something different. Katie has worked with various musicians and bands, Mike Scott and the Waterboys, David Kitt, Rady Pete, singer with the band Lancome, and Katie is with me in studio now. I'm going to play Eraser off the album, Katie, but maybe just tell me a little bit about the inspiration behind this, which I absolutely adore, I have to say.
I don't really usually start writing songs with an idea in mind. It's normally kind of a more organic process. But this particular time I was watching one of my favourite films, which is All the President's Men.
Yeah.
Very late at night. And
for the umpteenth time, I believe you were watching it.
Umpteenth time, officially the umpteenth, yes. And I just started hearing these cellos, the plucking cellos in my head. And I, had to kind of go straight to the piano and start writing it. So it's one of the only songs that I've really written that was super inspired by
something in front of you. And the opening lyric here is so strong. We'll erase while you hide. It's a very frightening statement.
Yeah. Well, it's the iconic scene of them, in the building flashing around with the torches and, so it kind of just the lyrics, those particular lyrics came to me at that time as well. So.
All right. Well, let's listen to Eraser from the new album from Katie Kim, Hour of the Ox.
To not hear. We don't know who you are.
Yeah, I can see that it was the cellos that started coming into your mind, Katie. That's Katie Kim and Eraser, which is the opening track, isn't it? The opening track on the new album, Hour of the Ox? I think it is.
It is the second track.
This is the second track on the new album.
Yes.
Yeah, and I'm sure you've spent hours deciding which would be one and which would be two. So, you know, it's not just
very important that it's number two. Yeah.
And All the President's Men, as I said, inspiring that wonderful cello playing in there. You were saying it was Kate Ellis who's doing it?
Kate Ellis, yes. Kate Ellis and a violin player, Shane O'Brien, just those two guys kind of creating these lovely, lush orchestras. So
yeah, because there sounds like there's more than two instruments there. Now, maybe they overdubbed and stuff like that.
The
but
magic of overdubbing.
I know. But still, it has a really full feeling to it. And what would you compose then? What would you write at? Are you writing at the piano or are you writing with a MIDI in front of you?
Mostly at the moment at the piano, yeah.
Yeah,
so I've got my trusty Nord keyboard that I couldn't live without. And I normally go to that. It used to be the guitar. I'm sure I'm going to reconnect with the guitar again at some stage. But yeah, the keys is what I tend to go to. Yeah,
I was asking you there because my memory was that yourself and Rudy Pete were sitting in front of me about a year ago or more. But no, you were saying, I think we were both down the line because it was at that time when we probably could have nobody in studio. You had gone to New York in 2019 and you were supporting Lancome, Rady Pete singer with Lancome. You were opening for them in, on some of their tour. And then suddenly you find yourself back at home because of lockdown and the two of you were 500 yards away, living away from each other. They were extraordinary. So that was how that collaboration then came up subsequent to that, wasn't
it? No, so actually that collaboration happened a couple of years ago. And then the collaboration was kind of reimagined with more members. So we decided to get other people in
on board. And Lancome Link as well here with John Murphy, who's producing Hour of the Ox Spud. How important is that producer relationship, particularly when it's you yourself?
It's really important. I mean, I'm good friends with Spud. We've known each other for a long time. He also plays with Katie Kim. And he has produced the last two records. And we just know each other well. It's really easy relationship. So it's a no-brainer really to go to him, because I mean, starting with a brand new stranger who doesn't know your taste, doesn't know your style,
takes half the day to
so it's just really lovely. And he just happens to be a really fantastic producer, which is always good as well.
That helps. Album launch then this Saturday at the Button Factory in Dublin. Is this the first major big live gig since?
It is the first gig that I will be doing in front of real human beings in 2 years. Don't even ask me, because I'm so nervous about it. But I'm really excited as well. So
because you're kind of you are a studio head. I think you enjoy that side of things more than you enjoy the live performance.
But this time I'm gonna have friends with me playing with me. So I'll have support. Support this with me.
She says,
I won't be all alone.
She says with a little bit of panic creeping into her voice.
I'm just not thinking about it too much yet.
And Katie Kim,
it'll be the only gig, by the way, in Ireland.
Where are you heading? Where are you heading?
No. I just wanted to keep it nice and simple. So it'll be a one-off show, and then I'll be doing one in Germany and stuff as well. Yeah.
And Katie Kim, the moniker, is going to be put to rest.
I think so. Maybe. Like to try something new.
And have you thought about that yet? Or is it just, go ahead.
I mean, to be honest, it's more of a challenge, and it just feels naturally, I mean, it just feels like a natural progression to try and maybe step outside of my zone and atmosphere and try something new. And I feel maybe challenging myself with maybe keeping Katie Kim the style of music that I make and that whole thing maybe to the side will help.
Right, so it's kind of like that in some ways that's a mask, and now you're going to try a new mask, or you're going to try maybe go barefaced.
I would never go barefaced, but I don't know. Try out a new mask.
Right. We'll finish with the second track. I asked you, did you want Feeding the Metals or Really Far? You said Feeding the Metals. Why do you particularly want this one?
It's a song that I haven't really written in this style. It's quite simple. And it's going to be the next single. So
Why not? That's a very good reason. Thanks for coming into us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Don't know who's going to be coming back in. Some other person with a different name.
Who knows? Yeah.
Yeah, looking forward to meeting her when she comes. This is Feeding the Metals from Katie Kim and the new album Hour of the Ox. We get all the credit, skimming from the bankroll. It was so pathetic, staring down a black hole. And everyone's left dreaming, blaming one another on another level, on another And that's Feeding on the Metals, track three, in fact, from Hour of the Ox, which is the new album from Katie Kim. It will be released this Friday. Katie plays the Button Factory on Saturday, the 10th of September. And as she was telling us there, that is the only Irish gig that she will be doing for this particular round. More details on katiekim.bandcamp.com. Now, we know through many iconic works that artists were very involved in the revolutionary period in Irish history, and names that trip from the lips are William and Jack Yeats, John Lavery, many others as well. One of the less well-known artists of the period was Estella Solomons, who was both a portrait painter and a member of Cumann na mBan. Now, an exhibition of her paintings is taking place at the National Gallery of Ireland. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by curator of that exhibition, Niamh McAnally. And as we go along, we will be tweeting some images from the exhibition, and you can, if you want to see those as Niamh is speaking, you can follow us on at RTE Arena. And I'm going to put one up straight away so that you can look at the woman we're about to talk about. This is a portrait of Estella Solomons painted by Francis Beckett, so that should be available to you on at RTE Arena as we're speaking. So Niamh, as people are looking at that particular image, tell us a little bit about Estella Solomons herself.
Well, she was a very interesting character, and I suppose it's a great opportunity for the decade of centenaries to celebrate an Irish woman artist. She was Jewish. They were a kind of a well-to-do Jewish family living in Dublin, lived on Waterloo Road. They were a very talented family, her brother being Bethel Solomons, of course, who was the very renowned physician and master of the Rotunda Hospital for a number of years. And she herself was a very, very talented artist, and but of course she was a member of Cumann na mBan as well.
Yeah, and that's I suppose one of the important and interesting aspects of that kind of revolutionary network that was there at the time was the fact that it transcended all kinds of religious boundaries, transcended class boundaries as well. That was quite ahead of its time, really, when you think about it.
It was. It was very progressive. And that's one thing that the exhibition shows, is the fact that a lot of these, whether they be, you know, very distinguished artists, literary patriots or politicians or whatever, a lot of them were her close friends. Mm. And, you know, they're shown alongside each other. And I've tried to make those connections between them and enhance the show by shedding light through the likes of archival material as well, yeah, about those connections that she had.
And in fact, you mentioned the family, you mentioned the brother being, was it the brother who
the
was
brother
the,
was who's the, Bethel
in Rotunda, yeah, and the portrait that we have up there, Francis Beckett, was an aunt of Estella's?
Francis Sissy Beckett was
Samuel Beckett's aunt, I beg your
Samuel
pardon.
Beckett's, yes, aunt. And she was a friend, a close friend of Estella Solomons when they were both attending the Metropolitan School of Art in Dublin, and they would have travelled to the likes of London and Paris, etc. And of course Estella was fascinated by seeing Rembrandt's tercentenary exhibition in 1906, which really kind of tapped into her whole idea about portraiture and etching, two things she absolutely excelled at.
Yeah, and that's this particular, I suppose this is Francis Beckett. If we go on to another piece, which is from Estella herself, which is Lady in a Red Tie, which she's not identified as being Estella, but it could be
her.
Well,
it bears a possible resemblance to Estella at an early age. I suppose it's a really, really striking portrait, really captivating portrait for even this really incredible strident use of colour in it. The background, the stripy green and red background, you'd almost say is like an expressionist painting.
Yeah.
But she had a very individual quality as a painter. She was a very, very sensitive portraitist, and that's something that comes across in the display as well, how kind of lively the different characters are on display.
Yeah, and I suppose when you look at that painting, as you say, the woman with the red tie, which is currently to view on at RTE Arena, you can certainly see a resemblance with the Francis Beckett portrait from that we tweeted to
exactly.
Start out with. So what kind of figures was Estella? It was portraiture to a large extent that she was involved in.
It was portraiture. So she would have painted the likes of her own family and again her close network of friends and nationalist friends. You know, she had a studio on Great Brunswick Street, 17 Great Brunswick Street, which she rented from 1910. And the likes of James Stevens, the great writer, was her neighbour below.
Yeah.
And, you know, the likes of the charwoman's daughter that he wrote, he dedicated to her brother Bethel Solomon. So there were these great kind of links between them all.
Yeah, and I suppose the fact that she would have been painting portraits, and we'll come across specifics with this, but of revolutionaries, people who couldn't be identified for fear that it would
exactly.
actually get them into all sorts of trouble. Maybe that's why Woman with a Red Tie is unidentified.
You never know, because at the end of the day, you know, we have a portrait in the collection, and, you know, we know for a fact that Estella did have to destroy a number of her portraits because, you know, it would have identified those sitters or incriminate them. So it was a fascinating time, I suppose, that she was painting in. You know, she was from a fascinating family herself.
And actually, you mentioned her studio. We have a photograph, which is part of the exhibition. I'll tweet that up now. This is Estella Solomons in her studio. And looks very like the woman with the red tie that we spoke about
indeed.
In the previous exhibition. Quite a tidy and well-organised studio, isn't it?
Yeah, she was an artist at the end of the day. She wasn't reliant on commissions. You know, she was, as I said, from a well-to-do family. Her parents, you know, her mother was like an aristocrat, Rosa Solomons. They'd come from England. They were very instrumental in developing the Adelaide Road Synagogue, you know, both funding it and actually in the building project. Her father was an optician. He had a premises on Nassau Street that's mentioned in Ulysses. So, you know, they were kind of well-to-do.
Yeah.
And as I said, she had lots of very interesting people passing through her studio, whether they be friends or insurgents, you know, rebels using it as a refuge almost.
And I suppose one of the nice things about that particular photograph that's up there now on that RTE Arena of Estella in her studio is you have other mementos like this. It's not just paintings. You have other stuff in the exhibition that gives us a real sense of the period and of her life.
We do. I've borrowed quite a number of pieces from the archive at Trinity College, both the Estella Solomons and Seamus O'Sullivan, who was her husband, archive, which came to Trinity in 1969. And this again sheds light on the kind of comrades or people that were her friends, who she was writing to in prison, whether it be the likes of Frank Gallagher or Ernie O'Malley, etc. There was lots of correspondence to and fro. So she wasn't an artist just, you know, portraying these people. She was a real support to a lot of the people that she engaged with as well.
Now, I know the next image that I'll tweet is a woman in riding habit. And this really has the whiff of revolution about it, doesn't it? Even though it's riding gear, it very much is like that early Irish Republican uniform, the uniform of the guys who
this,
would have been
this,
about and
this
the women.
This is it. Yeah, this is a stunning portrait of her very close, lifelong friend, Kathleen Goodfellow. Kathleen was from an affluent Church of Ireland family, and she herself was a poet and writer who published under the pseudonym Michael Scott. And she wrote a little book which is on display in the exhibition as well, called Three Tales of Our Times, which talked about the kind of atrocities of the Black and Tans. And the women, both Estella and herself, met while sheltering from snipers' bullets on Mount Street during the Easter Rising. And then the following year in 1917, both joined the Ranelagh branch of Cumann na Mban. So, you know, they were kind of a dynamic a duo in a sense, because then Kathleen Goodfellow was a very important person in Estella's life later on when she married Seamus O'Sullivan, the writer and editor of the Dublin Magazine, because she basically was one of its main patrons, and she kind of allowed it to survive in a sense.
Let's put up now a portrait of Sean Milroy again. This is pure Estella Francis Holmes. This is a kind of chilling quality to it, because he's staring straight out at us, looking right down the barrel of the camera, as it were, right at us.
Exactly. I think that's the striking thing about Estella's portraiture, is the fact that, you know, the portraits really command our attention. They're really compelling portraits. And the very fact that he's staring out at the viewer with this completely unflinching gaze would say, you know, this is a man not to be messed with, you know. And at the end of the day, he was an IRA commander.
There is also that aspect of it that you kind of think at any point the British soldiers could come banging into the studio, and he's ready to get out of there. He has that look about him as well. He's not settled and sitting.
He still has the coat on, and at the end of the day, he was a close friend and a political ally of Arthur Griffith. He was a member of Sinn Féin's national executive, and was a very interesting character as well. Spent periods of time in jail, of course, but. She does capture, as I said, his kind of commanding presence in a portrait like this. And again, the portraits in the exhibition, many of them have never been seen together, you know. So I've borrowed a number of works from different collections around the island of Ireland, whether they be from the Ulster Museum in Belfast or the Model in Sligo or Trinity College Dublin.
Yeah, and I'll tweet a further image now. This is on parole at RTE Arena, if you want to look at these portraits and pictures from the exhibition that we're speaking about this evening, exhibition of Estella Solomons, which is at the National Gallery, curated by Niamh O'Malley, who's telling us about him. This is a haunted figure who isn't looking at the camera. He's in profile to us. He's seen a lot. You can see there's a furrowed look on that brow.
Well, we don't know the identity of this sitter, and she has inscribed it in paint up on the top right, on parole. So this could be one of those many insurgents or rebels that passed through her studio. And as I said, these revolutionaries during the War of Independence who would have sat to her. And as I said before, she had to destroy a number of those portraits to avoid incriminating the sitters. And her own husband said about her studio that it was a place of quiet and of calm, and a place of refuge for many whose political and nationalist activities had brought them a very undesirable amount of tension, attention in the bad times, you know. So I think his kind of strained, look in this portrait really does reflect the tension of the times.
Again, a further image that I think is well worth looking at is a portrait of Alice Milligan, great writer of the period, great revolutionary of the period as well. As she's sitting in that seat, she also is one who's ready to get up and get out of the room quite quickly too. It's not a settled back, relaxed pose, is it?
Well, absolutely not. She is an interesting character, you know, writer, political activist, very much a key figure in the Irish cultural revival. And a great supporter of De Valera in his opposition to the treaty, etc. And, you know, within this portrait, Estella has captured, you know, the kind of sitter as if she's almost been kind of disturbed in her reading and, or almost as if she's about to get up out of the chair. So there's great kind of lively quality in a portrait like this as well.
We'll finish with a portrait of Frank Gallagher. Remind us of his particular role in the history of the period. A little bit more relaxed here. He's smoking a cigarette.
Well, Frank Gallagher was a very close friend of Estella's and would have frequented her studio a lot. He was a journalist, author, Republican, and you know, a brilliant propagandist as well for the underground Republican movement. Mm. And of course, later became was appointed by De Valera as the first editor of the Irish Press. And of course, he was a staunch supporter of the anti-treaty side. He was imprisoned and went on hunger strike on a number of occasions. One time he went on hunger strike for 3 days, and another time he went on hunger strike for 41 days.
Wow.
And the great thing is I've included a letter from him to Estella within the exhibition, where he basically thanks her from Kilmainham jail for sending him in some cigarettes and a chocolate cake. So
there you go. What about then post the revolutionary period and the Civil War period? What side, do we know what side of the debate she was on, and how did, or did she keep a very low profile?
Well, as a member of Cumann na mBan, she was on the anti-treaty side. Mm. But, you know, as I said, a lot of the portraits within the exhibition are kind of 1921, etc. Mm. So, you know, at that stage, you know, they were all friends.
Yeah.
So it's an astounding time that she was kind of working in. But as I said, there's a letter in the exhibition as well where she writes to her husband, just absolutely devastated by the death of Michael Collins. So, you know, It was just a fascinating time, basically.
Yeah, well, certainly. And we saw that commemorated so well in recent times as well. Thanks so much for coming into us, Niamh, to tell us about that. That's the Niamh McNally, and the exhibition Estella Solomon's Still Moments is on display at the National Gallery of Ireland from the 3rd of September through until the 8th of January of next year. The exhibition is free with an accompanying programme of learning events. ngi.ie is the website. Banded Country is the title of the debut collection of poetry from James Connor Patterson, title derived from the hinterland surrounding his hometown of Newry in County Down, now living in London. The collection is inspired by Connor's memories of growing up in an area with a specific dialect, a specific culture, and an area steeped in an identity shaped to a significant extent in the three-decade period of the Northern Ireland Troubles. Delighted to have Connor join us from his home in London this evening. Maybe we could start straight away with the opening poem in the collection, Connor. This is Bamboo Land.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Sean, for having me on. Bamboo Land. As one put drunk into the back of a parent's car, seized, it had seemed, by the adolescent desire to be reminded of one's feelings, this morning saw me return to Bamboo Land near John Martin Gardens. I went alone, spurred as I had been in previous years by the cousin who supplied the Sprite bottle lung, the beer, the suite of cobbled furniture pilfered out of Skips. Back then, we'd sit for hours atop broken doors and pallets until one of us, suddenly compelled to danger, would gaze square into the bamboo void and bid the other jump, as though nothing at all would stop us, as though neither one had thought, like Orpheus, that to descend in order to retrieve might leave us head propped against the lyre, might see us ascend again with scuff marks wound beneath the skin and trailed by the scents of bamboo, oak and whin.
And that's James Connor Patterson reading the opening poem in his new collection, that opening poem called Bamboo Land and the collection called Banded Country. So important to, I wanted to hear your voice reading that poem straight away, because that's how it's written on the page. You write it in that kind of dialect, like to be reminded of one's feelings, for example. Reminded is reminded with an A stuck onto the end of it as if it's one word, to be reminded of one's feelings. How important was that aspect of the writing of the poetry for you, James?
Oh, hugely. I think, you know, the main thread, obviously, as a writer, that you want everything to cohere and pull together is language, you know. And it would have felt disingenuous to write a book like this in, you know, standard or received English. And similarly, you know, with my kind of very limited Irish from, you know, back in my school days, it wouldn't have really rang true either. So I wanted to write this phonetically in the way that, you know, I grew up speaking, and the way that my friends and family all grew up speaking. And you know, there's there's precedent for that, you know. Somebody like Kavanagh would have been a big influence on that sort of thing.
Yeah, and the publicity material mentions about the dialect being inflected with Irish and Scots English, or Scots flavour to it. Was it important for you to have both aspects in there?
Yeah, I mean, inflected with Scots in the sense that writing in kind of a dialect tradition isn't something that is necessarily a tradition in Irish poetry. It's either, you know, writing in English or writing as Gaeilge. You tend to get a lot more of writing phonetically from Scots writers. So I'm thinking of people like Irvine Welsh, you know, poets like Tom Leonard, you know, another a novelist called James Kelman. You know, these are kind of the standard bearers that I would have looked to when I was developing what my phonetic language would have sounded like.
I was wondering to what extent, I'm from Monaghan originally, and I know there's a road from South County Monaghan across through Katie, that direction down into Newry. Now, during the Troubles, you wouldn't have dreamt of driving that particular road. It was full of army lookout posts. But when they were lifted and you drive across it, you suddenly realise the physical beauty of this area that was totally missed, obviously, during the period of the Troubles. Did you kind of feel there was a Newry needed a new advertisement?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and again, this question kind of became more pressing, I suppose, in the aftermath of the Brexit vote, when, you know, the border region came back into the public consciousness in a way. And I suppose people's only frame of reference when it came to border areas were, you know, kind of quote unquote, the bad old days, the days of the Troubles, when Newry would have been stuck with something like the epithet, which the book is named after, Bandit Country. I wanted to kind of portray a different Newry, a Newry that I knew, which was apart from that, you know, something which was steeped in folklore and urban legend and kind of family and community and those aspects that wouldn't necessarily have been reported, you know, in the news headlines during those bad days.
And in fact, you have a poem in here called "You," which "you" being the yew tree, which is the name for Newry in Irish, is on tour, which is Newr. I suppose that's where that Newry comes from. You know, it's a kind of an Ulster version, an Ulster Irish version on Newr. I suppose it might possibly be how it was said, and that's how Newry came in the renaming. Yeah. But you have travelled as well. When I saw a poem called "The Disappeared," I was expecting a totally different poem. So why don't we just hear the poem first of all, and we'll talk about your travel a subsequent.
It's kind of it's about thinking about, you know, connections between different regions. So obviously one of the, I guess, the more harrowing events of the Troubles was, you know, actually a collection of events would have been the trauma that was wrought on the families of the disappeared and the kind of ongoing trauma surrounding that. And when I was doing a little bit of research into that, I discovered that there was a kind of similar phenomenon during the civil war in Argentina during the 1970s, where, you know, victims of that conflict, particularly civilians, were kind of disappeared in a very sort of similar fashion. And it was about sort of thinking of those connections and sort of a universality, know, experienced through, I guess, the horror of war.
Let's hear the poem.
The disappeared. Even now, I find it difficult to imagine being a campesino, dicing sweet potato over the kitchen sink, my hands calloused from years of raising sugarcane and lemon. What could possibly be to such a life? Argentina is tending more important matters. I hand out leaflets in the Monteros for Santuco. In January, a transport plane is shot down and kills 13. I'm not sorry. Perón is not in power, so civility can rise again in the green-cut mountains of Tucumán, like Christ removing Lazarus's shroud, the sun shimmering off La Angostura, the blue and white of the flag in cloudless sky. And with these things, when they come, they wrap me like a present. Sometime close to dawn, with an oil rag in my mouth and a blood-stained pillowcase wrapped around my head, I'm thrown from a helicopter into the South Atlantic and sent to greet the fish. The last thing I hear is traitor or its equivalent. I have no frame of reference. The ocean carries me over thousands of miles, and when I'm disturbed again, I'm something else entirely. A rumour in the sand, perhaps, or a ghost without pasture. Someone who might be a shell or a fossil, foundations on an unfinished house, or four converged headlamps on a quiet country road.
That's the Disappeared poem from the new collection Bandit Country by James Connor Patterson. And it is extraordinary how, when we hear that read by you, James, what is essentially an Argentinian story, an Argentine story, becomes something totally different, as it does as the poem moves along. To what extent did you need to be away from Uri? Because I know there are travels to Spain as well, and you live in London now, to get to write about it the way you have.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, that home, or the concept of home, sort of comes into sharper focus when you move away from it. And, you know, there's a great sort of tradition of exile in Irish literature. You know, you think of Joyce's Dublin being written from sort of Trieste and Paris and different places. And, you know, even Heaney, when he was writing about the conflict in the north, had sort of moved not very far in terms of geography, but you know, he moved down to Wicklow when he wrote North and different political pieces.
So London has been helpful to you in that respect.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, listen, absolutely. Lovely to speak with you this evening, and thanks for being with us, James, and for sharing your collection with us. That's James Connor Patterson, and James's new collection is called Bandit Country. It's published by Picador Poetry.